Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Peg from the Atlantic City Young People's Group.
Hi guys, my name is Peg and I'm an alcoholic.
Amen.
I have recovered from a hopeless state of mind and body, and that's contingent upon my daily reprieve, spiritual daily reprieve. And it's nothing short of an honor to be standing before you here tonight, to be in 12-step work. I take it very seriously. I take Alcoholics Anonymous very seriously. It always comes first in my life. There was a time when I was not able to stand unassisted as a result of drinking, and I'll get to all that. But I do want to take the time to thank the home group for asking me to be here tonight. So my home group is Atlantic City Young People's. If you guys are ever down the shore, please come by. It's Clubhouse. There's meetings, 3 meetings a day. And it's kind of funny because they're not young anymore there. I mean, there's some young people, there's some new people there, but the group is so old that the people that started the group now have like 30 plus years. So any given time that you visit our home group, you're going to have over 100 years of continuous sobriety, at least, in the room. And it's a very sacred place for me. I love hearing the legacy stories of the people that came before me, because I believe that's part of AA's history, just as much as Dr. Bob and Bill. So I love my home group. We call it the House of Love, so just want to extend the invitation to everybody here. I know I spoke to a couple people that said that they go down the shore. My sobriety date is March 25th, 2013. I have a sponsor. I talk to her very often. I have sponsees, so I have the grace and the love and just the God-given experiences of being able to take women through the steps today, and I'm so grateful for that. And, I just want to tell you a little bit about myself and what it was like, then, of course, what happened and what it's like now. It's funny because every time I get to like what it's like now, I usually get a little emotional because it's just unbelievable to me today after everything that I've been through as a result of my drinking. But, when I was growing up and I was a kid, I have 3 brothers. I'm the only girl, and both my parents are members of sober members of Alcoholics Anonymous. Long time. They got married and they decided to get sober together, and, they went to the rooms of AA. Back then, rehabs weren't really a really big thing, so they just decided to go to meetings together. And they had 4 kids. And, when I was growing up, I felt a little bit different. Here so often in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, I felt different, didn't belong. You know, I'm the only girl. And there was a lot of bad stuff that happened to me when I was a little kid, so much so that I don't remember most of my childhood. And that stuff is not the reason why I'm an alcoholic, so I don't really talk about it that much. The reason why I'm an alcoholic is because if I pick up one drink, I'm thinking about the 12 after, what time the liquor store closes, if you left your purse by itself, and what comes after that. Obsessive thinking down the line. I cannot contain, I cannot maintain, I cannot control my drinking. Period, end of story. I've gone through brief periods of well-intended thought to do so, but it's just not achievable for me. So like I said, I was, I had the mixed up feelings when I was a kid growing up, like didn't really fit in and I got made fun of and all that bad stuff happened. So, when I had a beer around a campfire at the age of 16, it was kind of like a spiritual experience for me. I had that beer and all of a sudden you wanted to be my friend, you wanted to date me, and I felt like myself. And from that moment on, after I had my first beer, I was just seeking the beer. Like I wasn't really going too far out of my way, but anytime I would hear about it, I would be at that party, on the weekends in high school. And I didn't face any real consequences, and by real consequences, I guess I should reframe that as legal when I was a teenager. But the first in reflection consequence that I had, because my drinking, is a blackout when I was 21. So I was pretty smooth sailing. I'm a chameleon. I can act as if, and I can brighten up people's days and hide what's going on internally for a while before it really, hits the fan and you'll see any signs or symptoms. So I was able to carry that with me, that twist inside of me, for a long time. And the only relief that I ever got was from a drink. So that was manageable. It carried on. And it wasn't until I was the age of 24, my dad was killed tragically in a car accident. that I can now remember, alcohol became an emotional crutch for me. I started to drink it, and nobody understood why I drank more, and, you know, the self-pity came into play of, you know, you don't understand, and I drink like this because my father just died, and that's really where, you know, my tolerance started to rise. And before I knew it, at the age of 24, it's no longer just social drinking. It's whenever I would go to the bar, I'd order myself a shot and then bring drinks back for everybody else. And the sneaky behavior started to happen, 24, 25. Luckily for me, I went downhill real quick because alcohol became my best friend really quickly. And it pervaded over all of the relationships and interactions I had in life within just a couple of years. And I prioritized it over a lot of different things. So quickly from the age 24, 25, it only took me to about the age of 26 to become an everyday drinker. I was drinking in the morning. And if I didn't drink in the morning, I would have the shakes at the age of 26. And at that time, I would kind of start off with like having a pint of Captain Morgan in the back of my Jeep, just because I needed that little bit before I got home to have my glass of wine without anybody finding out, to it becoming a liter in the back of my Jeep, and then in the back of my car was too far. It would be behind the washer and the dryer, and then that was too far. It would have to be stored in the bedroom in between the towels and the closet, and, you know, just I had to have it closer to me, full access. And any time, at that point in time in my life, at any time, one of my friends or a boyfriend would recognize that maybe I drank too much, and they weren't really sure why, because they didn't see me drinking a lot, but I acted as if I had way too much to drink. I was entering into blackouts quite frequently, every single day, and no recollection of things that would happen, and they would start to realize this, and they would see my behavior. Anybody that called attention to that behavior was out of my life immediately. So boyfriends were just blown off, broken up with, on to the next one. Friendships, I burn bridges like the best of them. Forget the matches and flame, I was throwing gasoline on them. I never wanted to speak to you again because you were coming between me and my love. So I was burning a lot of bridges, and the second that I was calling out of work too much, I had a feeling they might fire me. I was changing my career. So I went from being a teacher to working in a bank to bartending. I mean, you name it, I did it all. Jack of all trades, but never really true passion and purpose in anything that I did. I was just really good because I'm a really good chameleon. I can learn really quick, and I can learn to please people really quick because the first thing that I was in love with and the first thing that I was addicted to is the approval in your eyes. And that's what drove me. Fear. Because if I don't have your approval, then you won't like me, then no one will like me, and that's the baseline of my fear. I didn't know this at the time. I was driven by fear. In this big book, when it talks about 100 different forms of fear, self-delusion, we're driven by them, which means that I don't even know who has the wheel. It's just happening unconsciously for me. And the only way for me to get out of that feeling is to drink. So before very long, by the age of 27, I'm drinking every single day. And I'm now my liter of vodka has changed into a gallon of vodka every single day, 3/4 of an entire gallon of vodka every single day. So I'm going to 3 different liquor stores in the week, purchasing 3 to 4 gallons at every liquor store. Just to keep up. Just to keep up. And when I wake up, I'm immediately shaking. And I'm living off of the little bit of savings that I have left. So, like, now, boyfriends and relationships became tools for me to survive. So I started to take on hostages. And they didn't know that they were hostages. And the day that they would find out, you know, you drank a lot last night, and I found this empty, you know, liter of vodka in between the couch cushions. Like, what's going on? They're starting to put 2 and 2 together. And I'm like, well, you know, there's this, it's not really that big of a deal, you know, that kind of thing. On to the next one. So while I was busy trying to fix, manage, and control all my external circumstances just to fix what was going on inside of me, and I didn't know what was going on inside of me. I didn't know that I had a physical allergy. I didn't know that I had a soul sickness, this spiritual malady. I didn't know that was happening to me. I was just trying to resolve it with one thing and one thing only. Manipulating people, places, things, and drinking on top of that because I couldn't stand the way I hurt people. It was that vicious cycle on a daily basis. So one of my last hostages, at this point in time, I'm living basically in a blackout for most days. I took another hostage, and he loved me so much and that he wanted me to meet his family in Ohio, and I lived in Delaware at the time. So that meant that we had to go on a road trip. And while I was packing, you can imagine, I probably agreed to that in a blackout. And while I was packing for the actual trip, I'm like, oh, wow, like, I'm going to be gone for 3 days, and I can only fit 2 gallons of vodka in my luggage, in my gigantic piece of luggage with a couple pieces of clothes in it. Like, I don't know how this is going to turn out. Oh, well, don't worry, I'll worry about it tomorrow. By the end of that trip, we were driving back from Ohio, crossing the border of West Virginia, and I started to go into a full withdrawal that I had no idea my body was capable of acting like. I had a full unconscious seizure. I had auditory hallucinations because I could not keep up with that gallon a day. I mean, I barely tapped into the second one. I was going through a very serious withdrawal. We just happened to pass, come up to an exit for a hospital. And I told my hostage at the time, listen, there's something I have to tell you. I'm an alcoholic and I haven't had a drink in a while and I don't know what any of that means, but can we just please pull off to this hospital? Pull off to the hospital, and by the time I reached the emergency room, I had a seizure right there in the emergency room. I had a heart attack. I'm 28 years old. I had a heart attack in that seizure. And luckily for me, we were at West Virginia University Hospital. And that must be a pretty big party school because they have a whole detox center in West Virginia University Hospital. So they knew exactly what to do with me, and I was there for 7 days. They saved my life. And when I came to on the seventh day, I thought to myself, I should probably call my mom because she's probably wondering where I am, and today is Christmas. So I call my mom, and I say, hey, Mom, it's me. She said, her exact words, woman of AA sobriety, continuous sobriety of, at that time, 38 years, I think, told me, I'm just glad that you're safe. When you get home, we'll talk then. So as you can imagine, when I finally left West Virginia University Hospital, went back to Delaware, there was my family, full-on intervention. If you don't go to rehab, then we're going to disown you. And I need my brother's approval, like I need air and food and water. So I said, yeah, absolutely, I'll go to rehab, for sure. And I go to rehab for the first time. And the thing about me, the chameleon inside of me that seeks approval, I do very well in rehab. I'm an alcoholic. Are you kidding me? I'm the actor on stage. Our big book talks about it. So when I'm in there, I'm showing the new people how to do laundry. I'm sitting in front taking notes. I'm like shaking hands with the H&I. I'm like, this is great. You know, like, I feel good. This is achievable. As soon as I leave here, I'll be fine. No big deal. I think we have that Jimmy Buffett concert coming up, but I'll be fine. No big deal. And I'm already lying to myself. And I come out, my mom's like, listen, if you're going to stay at my place until you get a place of your own, can you please at least go to AA meetings? Maybe try an IOP. I'm like, all right. If this means I don't have to pay rent, absolutely, I'll do that. So I go start going to AA meetings, and I come in late, and I look at the faces of you guys, and I'm like, no, I do not know these people. Why are they looking at me like that? What is that? That gibberish can just, I don't even know what that's about. And I leave before the meeting's over. So that's my mom. I go to an IOP. I don't know what it is about people like us, but like, we find each other, right? So we find each other that are doing the right thing, and we find each other when we don't want to do the right thing. It's like magnets. So I go to IOP, and I find the good-looking guy that sells non-GS approved substances. I'm like, you are now my best friend. That's what I do. That's my game in IOP. I bake brownies, and I bring them in to the class just to seek approval. And I'm sliding in AA meetings, and I'm running, and the people that introduce me creep me out, and I'm out of there. So you can imagine, alcoholic of my nature, who's used to drinking a gallon of vodka a day, goes right back to it. And I'll tell you what, I drive to that liquor store. I remember clearly driving to the liquor store, getting just over the bridge where I could see the top of Circle Liquor. And it's 8:56. They open at 9 a.m. And the relief starts to set in. And I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to buy a pint today. Just to kind of like even keel me out. By the time I get to the bottom of the bridge, I'm like, you know what? I got to do a liter because It'll be today and tomorrow. By the time I walk in there, I'm like pulling out 2 gallons. I'm like, this is more cost effective. I won't have to cross the bridge again. Less chance for a DUI. You know, all those things are coming into my head. And then I come to 2 days later and both those gallons are gone and my brother's standing over my bed and he's like, what are you doing here? You can't live it. You know, the vicious cycle begins again. And I'm on the run because I meet people that are like me and they want to hang out with me until I ruin their lives as well. So that's what I do. Dr. Jekyll, Mrs. Hyde. And, you know, and I'm running out of resources. That's the best way to explain it. Why do we stop drinking? I mean, for an alcoholic like me, I run out of resources. That's why I stop. And that's why I get the shakes and I go into detoxes because I run out of resources. So I made a really good friend in IOP and she was like, pulls me aside after IOP and she's like, you want to go to the bar tonight? Now listen, at this stage, I'm 29 years old. I already had a heart attack and alcoholic withdrawal. I've been to rehab once. I'm in and out of AA meetings, like, I have felt heart palpitations, lying in bed at night, going through withdrawal over and over again. I've already been to a couple emergency rooms, 2 different detoxes. It's probably not a good idea to go to the bar tonight, but if I do go to the bar, since I've just been drinking in the confines of my home for the last 4 years, unemployable, no friends, maybe this will be my opportunity to prove to everybody that I can just have a glass of wine or 3 at the bar, right? So we get to the bar, and as soon as we go in there, she's like, I don't have any money. I'm like, neither do I. But we're going to play a game called Let's Make Guys Buy Us Drinks. She's like, how do you play that? I'm like, just watch. So we're in a bar, and the Flyers are in the playoffs, and all the screens have the game on. And I scan the bar, and I see a guy in a Flyers jersey. And I'm like, let's go. Walk over casually to him. Stand right next to him. Do one of these. Hey. And he's like, oh, hello. I'm like, do you like hockey? And he's like, I love hockey. I'm like, well, I used to drive a Zamboni when I was in college. And he's like, can I buy you a drink? I'm like, oh, I thought you'd never ask. 3 weeks later, I was moved in. We were madly in love, planning our wedding.
Oh, my God.
And by the 5th or 6th week, he's finding my empties around the house. And here I am again. But there was something a little bit unique about this guy because, and the only way I can explain is that he had a God of his understanding that I didn't have at that time. Instead of kicking me out right away, he turned to me and he said, Peg, I think you have a drinking problem. What do you think about rehab? And I was like, I'm so glad you brought this up. I've already been to rehab once, and I didn't want to tell you before. But now I really think I'm an alcoholic. So I think I want to go for us. So I did rehab for the family. I went to rehab for him. And when I got there, I took all the notes, and I helped a new person. And I smiled, and I was like, well, I don't think we're going to Jimmy Buffett this year, but I think I'm going to be okay. So, you know, and when I'm in there, there is a couple day period where I'm feeling really good. That maybe it's a possibility. By the time I get out, I'm already thinking, like, maybe I could just have one. I've been without for like 30 days now, about 28 days, 14 days, whatever it is, the longest time I've been sober. Like, maybe if I just have a couple drinks tonight, it won't get to that point. By the first weekend I'm out, he comes home, finds me unresponsive on the couch. He has to call 911. Here I am in detox again. I mean, the vicious cycle just starts over and over again, and I'm no longer lying to myself about my intake. I'm just being a little bit more transparent with myself just about that alone, that I need this stuff, and whatever's going to come between us comes between us. And if he really loved me, he would understand that. So ensues the game of me hiding and then not hiding, and then I'm entering into more detoxes, and by this time I'm having bouts of pancreatitis. I mean, my body is just really starting to deteriorate. And after about 14 months of staying with him, living with him, and us trying to work this thing out, and me going to multiple detoxes and being arrested a couple of times, you know, he came downstairs and he was like, Peg, I have to talk to you. This relationship is over. Would you agree with that? And I was like, yeah, absolutely. He's like, so, you're in no condition to pack up your things and leave. So what I'm going to do, since this relationship is over and you agree with that, I'm going to pack up all your stuff for you. I've already paid for a storage space for an entire year up front. I'm going to give you the key to it, both of the keys to it. So it's your storage space, your stuff. I'm going to move it, but I want you to leave my house right now. I'm going to pay you $1,000 to leave my house right now. I take a deep breath, and I start to calculate all the alcohol that I can buy with $1,000. And then I look at him right in the face, and fear sets in, and I say, $2,000, and I'll leave today. So that ended up in a permanent restraining order against me. Did not go well. Kicked me out of his house. And if you would have asked me in the beginning of my sobriety how many times I've been arrested as a result of my drinking, I would have been like, four or five times. But since I'm a blackout drinker, no recollection, it was actually 11, and I found that out as a result of making amends in the process, which I'm super grateful for. So when I was taken out in handcuffs out of his place that evening, I came to him in the jail cell again the next morning, and I called a friend that I thought drank like me, and he came and picked me up from jail again, and he said, Peg, do you want to go back to Jeff's? And I was like, legally, that relationship is over. So I don't think so. What do you say we go fishing this weekend and drink and, like, hang out like we usually do? And on Monday, like, clearly I'm an alcoholic. Clearly I should not be drinking. Like, the habit is bad. Been to detoxes. You know, like, hospital, everything. But just for this weekend, because I'm going through a breakup, I think I want to drink. And he was like, all right, that's fine. And I was like, and then I'll get a job on Monday. I'll go back to AA. Like, that's the plan. Like, here's the plan. So just until Sunday, probably around like 2 o'clock, I'll shut it down. And Monday will begin my new life. And he's like, okay, great. That was the end of March of 2012. I came to July 13th of 2012 with zero recollection, even to this day, of what had just transpired. And when I came to on this guy's couch, I grabbed the bottle of vodka and I poured it into a cup, the warm vodka, and I drank it back and I immediately threw it up in the cup. And I drank it back again and I immediately threw it up again. And this is a regular occurrence for somebody like me that drinks like me. So I would pound on my chest and hold my nose and I'd like hop on one foot and I'd be like, man, like if I can't get this alcohol down, like I'm in trouble. I'm going to go through withdrawal again. I know what the deal is. And I just couldn't get it down and I couldn't remember the last time I had a sip of water, the last time I ate food, because I just came out of a blackout, and I did not feel good. So I asked him if he would take me to the emergency room, and he complied, and he took me to the emergency room, and when I went in there, they know me so well, they greeted me by name, and they immediately put me in a wheelchair. I went through the actual ER, and they rushed me right up to ICU. By the time they had strapped me in the bed in ICU and were attaching everything that you possibly could, I was being intubated. I was just hooked up to all these machines, and all I could really see and feel was the doctors coming in and out rushing. And I was even being tapped in the side, and I didn't really know what was going on. And the doctor finally came in and he said, Margaret, I'm really sorry to tell you this. You have multiple organ dysfunction syndrome stage 3. Stage 4 is coma and death. We don't know if you're going to make it through the night. Do you have any family? We need to call them. In all reality, what was happening was I had the onset of wet brain, and I didn't know what was going on. But I was 97 pounds and completely jaundiced from head to toe. I had a distended belly from the infection in my liver that was currently shutting down and operating at 20%. And it looked like I was pregnant with twins at 9 months. All of my organs were shutting down, and they told me that I probably wasn't going to make it. And before I knew it, my mom, who was sober 40 years, I was like fairly close to her anniversary now that I think about it too. She was sober for 40 years, was at my bedside. And she was crying. And then I would kind of come to, I was a little bit in and out of it. And then there was my younger brother, who's my best friend, and he lived in Philly. and he had tears streaming down his face. And then another one of my brothers came, and my other brother from Boston didn't even come. He said, let me know when the arrangements need to be made, and I'll come down for that. That's the kind of damage that I did, and I didn't even understand that I was doing. So as I hear the doctors kind of come in and out of the room, I can hear what they're saying to my family. And the only reason why I know it was July 13th is because there was a whiteboard in the back of the hospital room, and the day would change. So that's how I knew I was still alive. July 14th, July 15th. And they kept telling my mom they're not really sure why I've made it this long, but they're going to continue to drain my belly. They're going to continue to try this treatment that they've been trying on me, but they're not expecting much. And I would kind of come out of it and look to my left. And then one day I saw the faces of AA, the people that I ran from in those meetings years before. I have no idea how they knew I was there, but that was my first experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, being 12-step at my bedside on my deathbed. They were told not to come, that I wouldn't make it through. And I just remember seeing their faces. I couldn't hear their words, but my 12-step experience was love. I felt the love. As you can imagine, I obviously made it through that. They tried this radical steroid treatment the third week that I was in ICU, and it was either going to finish off my liver or help heal it, and it helped heal it. So by the fourth week of being in ICU, being in that hospital, the doctor came to me and he said, Peg, I have great news. You are, it looks as though your body's getting better. You've made it 3 weeks so far. So if this steroid treatment takes, then it looks like we'll be moving you to another hospital. So in that, after he left the room, I'm laying in that hospital bed, and I remember as much as I could possibly think at that time, because the best part about that entire situation is that my thinking mind had ceased because I had wet brain, the onset of wet brain. So I couldn't really think that much with my logical mind. It was more thoughts coming from my heart, from, my God's thought. And when that happened, I just remember looking up at the ceiling and saying, okay, I did this. Every decision that I've made up until this point led me back to a drink, which led me here. So I'm just going to start talking to you now because they say that I may or may not make it out of this hospital. And if for some reason you decide to keep me here, then this life is no longer my own, and I don't even know what that means. And just in that second, I had this wave wash of this overwhelming feeling of love and serenity and peace. It would be, to describe this feeling would be like describing God to a newcomer. It felt like a white light experience, if that makes sense to anybody here. When they tried that steroid treatment, my liver started to get better, and they moved me to that second hospital. And when I got to that, when I was wheeled into that second hospital, they were like, okay, you have a panel of six specialists that you have to see now for your liver, for your heart, for your kidneys, for all of your organs. You still weigh 97 pounds, so you're going to have to see a nutritionist. You can't walk, so you're going to have to learn how to walk again. So you're going to do physical therapy, and you have a long stream of medications that you need to take on a daily basis. And we're hoping that you'll be able to walk again, but we're not making any promises, and you're certainly not going to be able to run on your own. You probably are going to have blood transfusions for the rest of your life. We just don't have a high expectation, and we're sorry to tell you this way, but... And at that point in time, I had already felt like everything would be okay. So everything that they told me to do, I did. I took all the medications, I saw the specialist, I had all the blood transfusions. For me to talk about the medical side of it would take at least an hour and a half in itself. But the long and the short of it is that one by one, the specialists cleared me. And they offered the same thing to me. Peg, we're not really sure why your liver is operating at 85% now. Maybe it's because you're only 32 years old. and you haven't had a drop of alcohol in 6 months. So we're just going to go with that. And I'm not really too sure why your body started producing red blood cells again, and you don't need blood transfusions anymore. But we're going to say, we're going to call it youth, and hopefully you won't have any problems like this again. Your nutrition looks great. But none of them knew why. And at that point in time, when they were all clearing me, I was able to walk down the hallway unassisted. I'd learned how to walk again without a wheelchair, without a crutch or anything. And in fact, by the time they told me that it was time for me to go home in February, I remember specifically dancing with my iPod by the nurse's station and then telling me, "We think it's time for you to go home. You're dancing in the middle of the hallway." So I went into that first hospital July 13th of 2012, and on February 1st, 2013, I was being discharged from the hospital. And I called my mom up a week before I was being discharged, and I was like, "Mom, I'm cleared. I can go home at the end of this week." And she was like, "Not to my house." And I'm like, "All right, cool. Sounds good." About a half an hour later, my little brother called me from Philadelphia, and he was like, "Hey, Mom just called me, and she said that you need a place to live." And I was like, "Yeah, that's true." And he was like, "Well, my roommate moved out in the last 7 months when you were in the hospital, and I have this extra bedroom. And I was thinking about it, if you want to move in and just stay in the extra bedroom, go to AA every day. Our parents did it. It's got to work for you. Like, get a job whenever you can. Don't worry about rent until you really feel like, you know, you can stabilize your life. But just go to AA. That's the only requirement for you staying in my place." And I was like, "Dude, I can do it. I'm in." He's like, "Great. I live in a beautiful section of Philadelphia called Kensington." And I quickly settled in. And luckily for me, in that area, there's a lot of meetings in the city of Philadelphia. So I went to meetings all the time. And if meeting makers made it, man, I would have made it. Like, let me tell you, because I was in meetings all the time. But I was really, really scared to ask for a sponsor. And I was really, really scared to get my hand up and ask for help or even talk to anybody. And I did get a job, though, and I had a boyfriend in a recovery house that sold Suboxone to his house members. So I can achieve things in life, like, no problem. But 1 day turned into 6 days, 6 days turned into 6 weeks, and in 6 weeks I stole my brother's bike. I went to the liquor store, and I was drinking vodka on his couch again. He came home, and he found me. And he said, "What is wrong with you? I want you out of my house. I don't care where you go. You're done. I was the only person that will talk to you now. But before you leave, here's the phone. It's Joe, my brother from Boston." I'm like, "Hey, Joe, how's it going?" "I never want you around my family ever again. Click." So in that moment in time, I begged my brother to help me get into treatment. And he, by the grace of God, he did. He even drove me there and dropped me off with two trash bags of clothes that did not fit me anymore. My leg's still swollen with edema. I still have all these medications from the hospital. And I get there and I'm like, "Please just tell me what to do. I will do anything. Something is up here that I don't understand. And I don't want to drink. I drank against my will in Philadelphia. Like, I always drink against my will. Please help me." So everything that they told me to do, I shut up and I listened. And after 4 months of being in treatment, the week before I was leaving, you know, they suggested I go to a recovery house. And I had an exit interview with my counselor. And I remember sitting across from her and saying, "So when I leave here, what do I do?" And she was like, "Peg, you're a real alcoholic. You should get to an AA meeting as soon as possible. As soon as you put your bags down in that recovery house, get to an AA meeting. Get a sponsor and work the steps." And I was like, "Okay, what else?" And she's like, "That's it." I'm like, "There is no way a life can be built on that. I don't believe you." And she was like, "You have to trust the process." What she was really saying is, "You have to trust God," but I wasn't ready to hear that yet. I had only a brief interaction with God at that point in time. I had no conception whatsoever. So when I got to my recovery house, I had two trash bags of clothes that didn't fit me, threw them on the floor, an expired license from the state of Delaware. That's it. I mean, and that license was expired by 6 years. I don't even know why I carried it. It was worthless. And when I got there, I went to the first AA meeting that I could find. It was just a couple of blocks away from my recovery house. I knew it because I'd been to it before, and before I walked into the door of the AA meeting, there was a woman approaching me, and I look, and I turn, and I say, "Oh my God, Michelle, how are you?" It was a woman that 12-stepped me in the hospital. And she said, "Peg, you're alive. It was like a year ago that we 12-stepped you, just under a year. Everybody thought you died." And I was like, "I'm not. I'm here. Do you want to sponsor me?" And she was like, "Let's go to the AA meeting first." I'm like, no, I need a sponsor yesterday. That's what they told me to do. I'm going to an AA meeting. I need a sponsor. Like, and there's some steps involved. Like, please, just, like, show me. And she's like, "Let's go to the meeting first." Luckily, in that moment, after the meeting, she had the humility to tell me that she was currently getting her PhD, already had three women that she was taking through the work. But she said, "Peg, I have somebody that I sponsor that has already been through the work, and she would love to sponsor you. So all you have to do is call her." And I was like, "All right, cool. I'll take her. Let's do this." She's like, "Okay, but you have to call her. Here's her number." I'm like, "All right, well, tell her I'm calling, you know." And, of course, I wait, like, a whole week, and I call her. And we set up to meet, and we met. And she asked me to tell her a little bit about myself. And she's like, "Oh, yeah, you're a real alcoholic. So what we're going to do is every week we're going to get together, and we're going to meet. And we're going to sit across from each other, and we're going to read this book. And there's instructions in here, and there's prayers in here, and there's a lot of really good information. And if there's something you don't understand, just ask me. And if there's something you want to share on, let's talk about it. That's all it is." And I was like, "Well, my counselor said I have to go through the steps, though." And she's like, "Steps are in the book." I'm like, "Oh, two birds with one stone, this is turning out a lot better than I thought." So I did everything that the recovery house required of me. I got a job at Dunkin' Donuts. I was making all my chores and obeying the curfew and everything like that. And I was going to more than enough AA meetings a week, and I'm going through the steps with my sponsor, and all of a sudden I'm starting to realize that, like, wow, not everybody in the world is out to get me, because if you would have held a lie detector test up to me, I would have sworn to you that everybody is out to get me. Little did I know I'm the maker of my own problems. I had no idea. I did not know that when I was actually stepping on the toes of my fellows, I had no idea. And they were just retaliating. So we're going through this work, and I'll tell you what. I held on to a job, and I stayed sober. And time was moving on. And I was astounded by what I was learning as a result of this work. And it became time for the amends. And when I wrote that list, I was like, yeah, no problem. Like, if I don't do this, I'm going to drink again. No problem. I will do this. So I wrote the list, and my brother from Boston was on that list. And I was like, he's not taking my calls. I don't think he can be seen. Well, we write him a letter. So I wrote him a letter, because wherever possible was in that recovery house. And I wrote him a letter, and I sent it in the mail, and I didn't get a response. He didn't call. I knew he wasn't going to write a letter back anyway, but I didn't get a response. And I called my sponsor after about 2 weeks, and I was like, "Penny, you know, Joe didn't call." And she was like, "And?" I'm like, no, you don't understand. Like, everybody else is accepting my amends, and they're all excited and everything. And, like, I just thought he would have called by now, that's all. And she said, "Peg, we don't do these amends to seek approval from people. Wasn't that on your fears list? You didn't want to lose your approval." And I was like, "Ooh, yeah, okay, we're recapping it back to the fourth. Great, here we go. Yeah, that's what happened." She's like, "Well, we just do this to keep our side of the street clean and to keep that channel open for God. And so you can help his kids. That's it. The result is none of your business." I'm like, "Oh. All right, well, what about, like, my family? Like, I want to get my family back. Like, everybody else gets their family back." You know, all of a sudden, my ego had regenerated. Like, I'd forgotten what I'd done to them all those years. And she was like, "Well, why don't you just make AA your family for right now? And maybe one day your family will come back." Because nobody was really talking to me at that time. When I burn bridges, I burn them to the ground. A lot of the phone calls that I was placing to gain permission to make amends, they were just hanging up on me and then blocking my number. So I went through that process, and that was a really important part, because that was when she said that to me, that was when I was finally able to let go absolutely of the first thing in my life, right? With my own will, aligning my will with God's and letting it go. Not just directly asking God to remove it. Like, okay, if this is the purpose of me being here, is to help God's kids, I have to let this idea go. Because it'll, my sponsor said, it'll help me down this path. And it was like a relief. And AA did become my family. And because I was able to do that, I was able to carry through clear-headed in 10, 11, and in 12-step work, I could share that experience. And I got to the 12-step, when we were working with others, nothing ensures anything like immunity from drinking. It's intense to work with other alcoholics. And I was like, that's it. That's what I want right there. I want immunity from drinking. Why didn't we read this first? She's like, well, this is the 12-step. There's a couple that come before it. I was like, oh, yeah. Sure doesn't remind me. You know what I mean? Like, clue me back in. And I was like, what does this entail? And she's like, wow, it means you're going to sponsor women. I'm like, oh, no. I can't do that. I'm not going to sponsor a lady with 5 years like you. Like, I can't do that. She was like, yeah, that's what intensive work is. I'm like, oh. So I guess I have to do that. She's like, yeah. I'm like, well, how do I do that? She's like, well, it's easy. Tonight, after we're done reading this chapter, you're just going to, in your prayer, you're going to ask God to send you somebody that you're divinely crafted to help. And then you'll wait. And you'll be aware. I'm like, that's it? That's all I have to do for this 12-step work? And she's like, yeah. So I did that. Literally a week later, first sponsee came, and they have not stopped since. And I'm so grateful for that. Because when I sit across from them, I see another version of myself that's unhealed. And I'm teaching them this book and the inventory in it and the fears that are associated with it. And it's like I'm teaching myself how to heal. So, I started sponsoring women, and that to me is the bright spot. That's the good stuff, right? Like, that's what I live for, is being in 12-step work. And then, a little more time went on, and I remember, I finally had a year of continuous sobriety. And I was so excited, because at this point in time, I had a better job than Dunkin' Donuts. I was waiting tables, and I had a position in my recovery house. The secretary, and, things were just happening for me, not to me, for me. And I went down to my home group, and I picked up my chip, and my sponsor was there, and all my AA family was there, and I was like, yeah, super pumped. And I remember getting home, and I'm like, God, I live in this recovery house, and I'm like, the president of the recovery house, like, how did this happen? Like, I'm so grateful. I'm upstairs, doing my little Oxford bookwork, knock at the front door, and then the doorbell rings, and I'm like, who rings the doorbell at a recovery house? That's got to be the cops. I hope this isn't another amends that I owe on a silver platter, just arriving on my one-year anniversary, and I'm like, oh, no, better go downstairs and answer it. Run downstairs, open the door, and there's my brother from Boston with flowers in his hand. And he's standing there with my little brother from Philly. And I just let out a yell, and I started crying immediately. And I said, what are you doing here? Today's your birthday. You should be with your family in Boston. And he said, today is more important for our family than my birthday will ever be. And that was the best day, because I was with all my brothers and my mom. And we just ate pizza. And I was completely present in the moment with them. And they were present with me. And they weren't watching to see if I was doing anything wrong. And they weren't going to the next room to talk about what decision needs to be made next. We were just eating pizza together. So, there's a lot of really amazing things that have happened to me as a result of doing this work. And I realize the more that I push and dive into this work, the better my life becomes. It just happens. It just comes. And don't get me wrong, there are down periods. Trust me. When I had a year and 9 months, I got a phone call from my mom, and she was in ICU down in Cape Regional, and she was like, you know, can you come visit me? I just got into ICU. I haven't been well. I'm like, I had this feeling, this intuition from my God spot, from that same place that I've been denying and burying for so many years. Now it's clear. So I've been through the work. I'm taking others' women through the work, and I have this intuition that's just shining up, and I can't deny it now. And the intuition in that moment said, go to her. What I didn't tell you is that at the top of my 4-step was my mom, and the bottom of my 9-step was my mom. We had such a terrible and torrid relationship that it literally drove me to tears, to drinking, I mean everything, and it was always me blaming her. So caught up in such a severe subconscious resentment for years was really hard to unveil when I got sober. And it started for me with little things. Just showing up for my mom, trying to be present. My sponsor used to tell me, sometimes you just if you can just bite your tongue around your mom, that's the most spiritual work you can do. It was really challenging for somebody like me. So when I got that call and that intuition came, that resentment went right out the window. And I raced down there and I sat with my mom in ICU. And it's funny because I used to crochet, and I brought this crocheting a blanket. I had my cell phone and a book, and I brought all these tools to escape. And when I was there with her, I didn't want to. We just sat and we talked like old friends. And I didn't want to use my cell phone, and I didn't even want to crochet, and I didn't want to like act as if. I didn't want to go anywhere, and I certainly didn't want to run to a guy, and I certainly didn't want to run to a drink. I just wanted to be there with her. And we talked for hours. That was one of the greatest gifts. I mean, I knew walking out of there that this is it. Like, I just need to make that verbal amend. And I belong in this now. This is the relationship that I want. This is a relationship I've always wanted. And it's here. It's capable. I'm present. She just told me that she was proud of me. I'm hearing things that I've never heard before in my life. Like, this is where God lives. This is where God shows me. So she was in the hospital for a little bit. She's getting better. We're making these arrangements for her to move back into her apartment. And I remember, like, you know, even things were coming out of my mouth. I was in the hospital. You know, I was visiting her regularly, bringing her things, and just sitting with her. And again, not on my cell phone and just being present. And my brother was there one night, and they were kind of arguing about the stuff to bring, you know, getting the medical bed and the stuff that she needed for her apartment returning home. And they were arguing. And I turned to both of them and I said, you guys, we don't have any more decisions to make today, right? I mean, we've done the best that we can possibly do in today. The rest of the decisions are left for tomorrow when the social worker comes. So why are we arguing? Why don't we just enjoy this time that we have together? And like, that's not me. That's what I learned in AA. And my brother and I left there, and I remember, he was like, that was one of the most profound things I've ever heard. And I'm like, yeah, it's one day at a time, bro. You know? We left there the next morning. I went to my sponsor's house. She just had a hip surgery, and I brought one of my sponsees, and we're being in service, and my brother called me, and he's like, Peg, Mom died in her sleep last night. And she was set to go home the next day. So it was quite baffling. And it was really hard because this is the first thing that I've experienced where I couldn't anesthetize myself. So I took a deep breath when he told me that, tried to let it permeate my thinking and understanding. And the first thought that came clearly was, thank God I'm sober. And the second thought was, how can I help my brothers? Because they do not have a God of their understanding like I do. So I have to be there for them. And I don't know what that looks like, but God, please help me. See? And he did. And I was there for my brothers. And in that time period, I was full of a level of depression and pain. And just almost like a surreal feeling moving about life. I didn't want to get out of bed. I didn't want to go to work. certainly didn't want to go to AA. Absolutely not. But I knew, because I heard in the rooms, that you still have to keep showing up. So that's what I did. I showed up for my AA commitment. I went to my home group once a week because it's all that I could stand. And I met with my girls with the book twice a week. And if somebody called me to ask me to speak, I would show up for that too. That's the bare minimum that I could do and show up for my job. I mean, I was crushed. My soul was crushed in a new way. When I would sit with my girls, I'd be so into reading this work that I would forget for like 15 minutes about all the pain, and I'd be lifted from it. And what I always do with my girls when we're done reading, they say, how do you feel? What do you think? Like, oh my God, this is amazing. I didn't realize that. I would just listen intently to what was going on with them. And then they would look back at me and be like, how do you feel? And then I would realize what my life was. And I would come back into it. But those moments gave me hope. Right? Little pieces of hope. And I started to meditate a little bit for like 2 minutes at a time. And that gave me hope. And then I'll never forget this. It was the end of February, and it was my mom's birthday. And I was still really in the battle, if you will. It was about 2.5 months after she passed away. And I was leaving work, and I just became overwhelmed with grief. Like a grief I never felt grief before anyway, but just a sadness, an overwhelming sadness I'd never felt before. And I didn't even get into my car before I was hysterically crying. Like the kind of crying where like your chest is just out of your shirt and dry heaving because there were no more tears coming. I'd never experienced anything like that in my life. I never even cried before in my old life. Like I didn't know what was going on. I thought I was having a panic attack. I'm like, okay, I just need to make it home. Like, this is really uncomfortable. I don't know what's going on, but this pain is acute. It's real, and I don't like it, but I'm just going to go home. And I'd pass bar, and then liquor store, and then bar. Like, God, just get me home. And then the crying got worse, and by the time I got home, I get in the shower, and I'm hysterically crying, choking on the shower water. I'm like, God, please, 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 please. I do not want to drink. If I drink, this is going to get a lot worse. So please, just show me a sign that these pieces are going to come back together again. One day. Not tomorrow. Not the next day. I don't care when. And I'll look for a sign. Right? Because I know it's going to happen in your timing and in your way. It's not going to show up in a little blue box with white ribbon. Like, I will just stay aware. And that's my job from here on out. But please, just show me, like, give me that slice of hope that it'll happen. Like, it'll be okay again. I don't understand why I got sober for this. So I get out of the shower, and I fall asleep crying. And I wake up really early because I have to go speak at a meeting. I'm like, this is the last thing I want to do. It's the end of February. It's 6:30 a.m. I wanted to drink last night. Now I'm a speaker for me. I don't even want to do AA anymore. Like, I'm like, how am I doing this? I don't even know. Driving to the meeting. It's freezing out. I get inside, and it's one of those meetings where they ask who feels like having a drink or if anybody's had the thought of a drink. And I wanted to be like, me, the speaker. I feel like drinking right now. But my ego went up because speakers don't, they don't go through that. And I went through my story, and when I was halfway through my story, I felt the truth rise up, and I said, no, I have to tell you, I do feel like drinking right now, or there's been spots, but I've been asking God for help, and I've been sitting with sponsees, and I'm making it through this, you know, and I finally told the truth, thank God, and then they went around the meeting space for people to share, and there was this gentleman, he said, hey, I'm in the show and I'm an alcoholic. And we're like, hi, Joe. And he said, Peggy, you don't know me, but I know you. I've been looking for you for months inside AA meeting. Like this creepy old dude in the corner. Nobody's sitting by him. And I'm like, he's like, I actually went to your job, the crab trap. You work at a crab trap, right? I'm like, okay, nah, this is like too much. Like, what? Why are you, like, please stop, you know? He's like, I'm so sorry. You probably think I'm really weird. The reason why I'm telling you this is because I met your mom, and it was the night before she died. But she was doing well, right? And I was like, it's like I sat with her because somebody, a mutual friend of ours, asked me to come and give her the Eucharist. And I have to tell you, I've been looking for you because when I gave your mom the Eucharist that night, she had rosaries in her hand and she clutched them so tight to her chest that she gave me faith in a relationship with God that I didn't understand yet. And she told me about you because AA came up and she said, you must know my daughter. She's the prettiest girl in AA. She goes to meetings in Ocean City and in Atlantic City. You should go find her and talk to her. So I had to come find you. Sorry that she passed away. When I left that meeting, I knew that God's going to speak to me in brick walls when I least expect it. And to pray for patience is just absolutely ludicrous. And like, if you would ask me in the beginning of my sobriety, you know, what's important? What would you like for yourself? What is the life beyond your wildest dreams? You know, I don't know what I would have told you. I probably would have told you to be able to walk again. That would be great without a demon in my legs. To get a waitressing job. And then I did that and I would have gone down this list of material things. I want an SUV with a golden retriever. You know, like those kinds of things. But to me today, the life beyond my wildest dreams is having that channel and that refuge right here. That I can pray, I can slide off into a bathroom, or anything that happens, I can tap right in and be relieved. That's a gift beyond measure that I can't put into words. And I've accessed it quite regularly to assure myself that I still have it. That's all I got. Thanks for having me.